It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Leo's off today. I'm Mike Elgin, filling in. Twit's news director. Jeff and Gina are here, and so is Matthew Ingram. And we'll tackle Google's never-ending Euro troubles. Facebook apologizes to the drag queen community. And we talk about how Google's competitors are slamming Google for not focusing on the user. It's all coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 269, recorded October 1st, 2014. Regina McTrapezoid. This Week in Google is brought to you by Citrix GoToMeeting, the proven solution for meeting and collaborating online. If you sign up for GoToMeeting before October 10th, you'll get another Citrix product free for 6 months. Visit GoToMeeting.com and get started. And by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to PersonalCapital.com/twig. And by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace that connects people who are looking to borrow money with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/twit and receive a $50 Visa prepaid card when you get a loan. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, the show where we talk about Google and all things cloudy. Leo's on vacation in the still United Kingdom. I'm Twit's news director, Mike Elgin, filling in for Leo today. Joining us, as usual, is Gina Trapani, the creator of ThinkUp.com, host of Twit's All About Android, founding editor of Lifehacker, and all-around great person. Welcome to you, Gina.
Hello.
Trapani.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What's new with you?
You know, not too much. Just hanging out, reading the Google News, excited to discuss a few items.
All right. Well, me too. And we also have, speaking of people who discuss things, Jeff Jarvis, professor of journalism at the City University of New York, author of Public
Works. I'm going to try to hypnotize you with my moray pen.
Yes, I will. Do anything you say. What would Google do in Gutenberg? I have to go through your list. And you also recently published something else you said was started out as a white paper of some kind.
In November, I'll be coming out with Geeks Bearing Gifts, Imagining New Futures from News.
Can't wait to read that. And of course...
Oh, you can wait, believe me. Very well.
You're quite the promoter for that.
Yeah, what a plug. And Jeff, of course, blogs at BuzzMachine.com. BuzzMachine.com. Yeah, BuzzMachine.
That's after three glasses of wine. It's BuzzMachine.
That's right. And joining us as our guest, Matthew Ingram, senior writer at GigaOhm.com, obsessive tweeter on all things journalism. Welcome to you, Matthew Ingram.
Thanks for having me.
How are you doing? What have you been up to these days?
I'm good, you know, just hanging out, doing some kayaking, you know, waiting for winter to come.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, and of course, it's pretty harsh
coming
where you are, right?
It can be. Certainly last year, yeah, we were snowed under for a good long time, so.
Nothing
luckily,
to be trifled.
I get to San Francisco now and then, so I get a break.
See, in these parts, San Francisco is the coldest spot in the area, so anyway, come to Petaluma if you want warmth and sunshine. Well, let's jump into the news. Google bows to pressure, removes news snippets from German search results. I bet you, Jeff, you have a few things to say about this. Basically, what's happened is that people said, hey, we want a cut of the profits from that gravy train that Google's got going on, where they, you know, basically put little snippets of news articles with the link. And so Google said, well, you know, just in case, we're just going to go ahead and remove some of that information, and it's probably going to affect them. So, Jeff, what do you think?
Be careful what you wish for, mein Freund.
Exactly.
Axel Springer, which is the big conservative News Corp-like German publisher, which has been waging war on Google and brought together other publishers to sue Google, they got this law passed, which I've talked about before. We've done a reggae beat on the Leistungsschutzrecht. And it's an ancillary copyright law. And then... the law went through all kinds of changes, and then snippets itself were not verboten. But then the publishers, it's too complicated for morals, but the publishers then sued Google, saying that Google was still stealing from them and wanted, I think, 11% of Google's revenue or some such thing. And so Google, you know, does what, of course, Google needs to do. They just said, okay, fine. So we'll take down the snippets. They will still put up headlines, but no snippets and no photos. And I'll bet you anything the publishers will lose traffic. But, of course, the publishers are now going to turn around and say, I just tweeted this. And they're already starting to say it. I predicted they would, and they already are saying, well, you're using your oversized influence here to take down the content that we sued you to take down. So it's a cluster F in Germany. I was in Mountain View, brought out there, paid only expenses, nothing, no fees, to speak to the support engineers and sales engineers for what they now call work, a joke people under 50 won't get. So I did my spiel about Germany, and they said afterwards, well, you wound the Germans up here. But it's a huge, huge issue. While I was there also, another story happened where a privacy commissioner in Hamburg has told Google that they may not create any user profiles without explicit permission from every user, which is absurd and ridiculous. And, of course, every publisher has user profiles. Everybody has user profiles. And, indeed, I argue that publishers do a better job of it. But Germany's really become – I spent the entire plane ride coming back from California just now – writing a piece about the German problem that I want to place somewhere in the German press.
Now, they would have a case, I would think, if a significant number of people used Google News or Google Search as their newspaper, just reading the snippets and the summaries or whatever and never clicking on the links. Is this entering into the case at any point, the degree to which Google Search is being used as an alternative to clicking on the links and looking at the actual sites?
You know, that's part of the argument that's been made for some time. I actually haven't heard it lately, that people just read the snippets and they don't need to read us then. But of course, we know that snippets cause links to happen. And there hasn't, I've always wanted to do a study at CUNY, and I've never managed to get it going, because I need cooperation of publishers to do this, to find out what is the optimum size of a link. If it's too short, if it's just a headline, I will bet you it will not work. If it's too long, yes, if it's the whole story, one could argue it takes over the whole experience. However, I've seen with repost.us that 5% to 7% still click through to the source to read more. If it's a description that tempts you and wants you to go to the story, then I think that will probably increase the click-through. And so we don't know yet what's optimal for linkage.
You know, like the thing that I keep saying since this argument about Google and Google News first came up, which feels like 10 years ago, maybe it wasn't, but it feels like that long. And my point is, if a headline and two sentences from your story is enough to give people the value they need from that story, you have a problem with your story. It's not Google's problem that two sentences or a snippet from your story is enough and people don't want to click through or don't see the value of clicking through. It's if you don't make your content compelling enough so that that's enough, then that's your problem, not Google's problem.
But isn't the standard generic newspaper format to be reverse pyramid style, where the first paragraph tells you the basic information, the second paragraph tells you, so it starts out very large and ends up getting more specific. And so if that's actually the style the newspapers are using, and in fact, if Google is taking the top part of it, aren't they really giving you the main part of the story, the nut of the story, or whatever you want to call it? I mean, I think the proof is in the pudding. If people are actually using it as an alternative, which I don't believe, then that's one thing. But you know, a lot of times people skim. People are skimmers now. That's another problem that we have in our democracy now, that people aren't really reading more deeply.
Well, I'm gonna disagree. Right. I'm gonna disagree in a couple of ways, Mike. I think first, the fact that we skim, we hit more stories and more facts and more things than we knew. Talk about skimming. If you got your news from 22 minutes of the evening news, all you got was the skimmage.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And now you get more. Number one. Number two, I wouldn't presume that people don't read in depth. This is part of the logical fallacy of the links are theft argument, as opposed to the links are gifts argument. People just read the link and they didn't read our story. Well, who said they were ever going to read your story anyway?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're trying to prove a negative. You're trying to say that they would have come to your story had they not read the link to your story. That doesn't quite work out either.
But people used to walk by newsstands all the time and look at the headlines. Exactly. No one complained about them stealing the news by reading it, right, off the paper.
And now we see a movement aborning here in seeing that the getting away from the mass media metrics of reach and frequency, unique users and page views, raw eyeballs, into higher value metrics of attention. And so Chartbeat, the company in New York that does pixel by pixel activity on pages, metrics for those, was certified as of Monday to be the first place to measure attention. And so you have the Financial Times working with Chartbeat to sell 10,000 attention minutes of CEOs in Europe. You have a Medium selling advertising by time rather than by eyeballs and attention and mirror impressions. You have the Economist following suit. So you have a movement now going to say that we're going to sell attention. Now, that doesn't mean, by the way, that you have to spend 2 hours reading the story. Tony Hale, the CEO of Chartbeat, argues that for Circa, for example, going back 20 times a day can be just as valuable as spending 20 minutes there to the advertiser.
Well, and their measurement is over time, too. It's an aggregate. It's not just exposure time to a specific story. They look at exposure time over a month or whatever. So if you come back enough and read enough.
There's also a branding element here and also some assumptions that are being made. And I did my best to play devil's advocacy, but in fact, I'm completely on Google's side and against the German lawsuit and so on. Because what I found as a blogger is that I often promote my own stories on Google Plus and elsewhere. And what I've found over the years is that if I give enough of the story, sometimes more than my editors and the publishing companies they work for are comfortable with, then actually promote the idea that people can get all they want, dip into it and really understand the story just from my little summary, then the link, which is a promotion, an ad basically for the story itself, is more likely to go viral. People will share it. They'll comment on it more. They'll plus one it more if they understand the whole thing. And there's got to be some kind of equivalent metric for search results because, if you give a really good, juicy summary that's enough to really get, that's going to spread like a story and then that's all promotion. So personally, I found that being super cryptic or just giving a little tiny bit and being stingy with giving people a real sense of what the what's on the other side of the link works against you for promoting traffic to the sites itself. So I think they're making an assumption there that I think needs a little bit more examination.
What's interesting to me is if Google is actually stealing eyeballs or whatever by having previews or snippets, Twitter does a lot of that too. Their Twitter cards, the expanded view of articles, they've got effectively photo, headline, in some cases the first paragraph of articles. I wonder why no one.
Do you have any insight into how those work versus just a simple headline in terms of click through from tweets?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I just set them up for ThinkUp, actually. The publisher is actually setting those up. So there's a few different styles of Twitter cards. You can do the big image. You can do the small icon. You can do, the summary and the headline. There are some special Twitter cards, like you can show photo galleries and that kind of thing. So if you ever see a news article that has that Twitter card enabled, like that publisher has set that up and enabled that, and you have to get whitelisted and you have to have these particular tags in your markup and stuff. So then that's a different thing than what Google does, which is Google figures it out and shows it kind of on their own. With Twitter, you're actually setting it up.
You do it. Right. I just find it interesting that lots of publishers seem to see the value in doing that to the point where they actually set it up themselves. But then you have other publishers who obviously don't, and in fact see that as a negative thing.
It's a little different because people are commenting. So someone is saying something about the article in their status update on Facebook or in the tweet, and then there's the attachment. And of course those sites they send a lot of traffic, as does Google. Just to your earlier point about writing headlines and snippets and having something, something is wrong with your story if the reader is satisfied by just previewing the snippet. I wonder though about how that has created the sort of rise of the Upworthy style curiosity gap. True. You won't believe what happens when this kitten jumps into a bucket of ice kind of style headlines that we've talked about here that get shared so much and go viral on Facebook. Sometimes people don't even read it. Right. Right? They're like, yeah, this is great. So I wonder about that a little bit. I don't know that those are necessarily bad, but the clickbait style.
Yeah, no, I actually was thinking more in terms of, it's similar, I guess, to what Mike was saying. I think if you have delivered value to readers in the past, that is you, the individual, you, the writer, or you, the media outlet. And if you've given them something before that they feel was valuable, then they're not going to just, do you see what I mean? They're not going to, they're probably going to click through because they expect that you will have things that are worth reading. Whereas if you do go for the sort of clickbait stuff, you actually wind up doing the opposite of what you think you're doing, because then the reader does click through and doesn't have a good experience or feels tricked or whatever. And so then it actually, you're further in the hole than you would be if you hadn't done that.
But this all goes to the outmoded mass media metrics that we operate under.
Right.
Of and advertising means that we operate under of impressions and volume rather than value. If journalism is a service, as I like to say these days, then the service is accomplished if you're informed and know what you need to know. However that happens, we only have a model that says you have to come and read our whole story and spend time looking at as many ads as we can plop in front of your eyeballs so we can rip off the advertisers, charging them for these supposed impressions of you. That model doesn't work on either side. It doesn't work for the consumer. It doesn't work for the advertiser. Now, Google came along and offered a better deal, which was performance, and that was a step in the right direction. The Magazine Publishers Association just for the first time this week started revealing their audience across all platforms for 147 brands and 30 companies. Chartbeat, as I said earlier, is now going to do with attention. I don't think either goes far enough. I think what we have to go to is that you have a valued relationship with a news provider, and we find new ways because of that relationship, because of the value we can bring you, to give you something back in return. And you know, we haven't begun to do that.
Felix Salmon wrote about something, what he called promiscuous media, which is media that content effectively that lives wherever it needs to, whether it's YouTube or Medium or Twitter or Facebook, content that's effectively designed or intended to live there in that environment on that platform, not to just be a call out to please click and go to our site. But in order, as you pointed out, in order for that to be seen as valuable, you have to be monetizing your content in different ways than just driving as many people as possible to your specific corner of the web.
Now, part of this, go ahead, Gina.
I'm sorry, Mike. I was wondering what you guys thought of. This was a few weeks ago, maybe a couple months ago, but the Saved You a Click controversy about the Vox piece. The headline was, "Did Tony Soprano die at the end of The Sopranos?"
Right.
And they had the answer, but it was six paragraphs into the piece. And there's that Twitter handle, Saved You a Click, which, no spoilers, put the answer. and then someone wrote, I forget who it was, maybe was it a Verge writer, another Vox writer, but someone wrote this very angry, you know, long piece explaining why this person had done, stolen experience, and this person had done all this work to write this amazing long story that like builds you up to the big reveal, and that took it away. And yet, you know, as a very casual, not even really a big fan of The Sopranos, but still sort of wondered, I was like, oh, great, thanks.
It was a service to me. I actually went and read it. I mean, even though I got the answer from Saved You a Click, I still went and read it. So I guess, I don't know, maybe
you cared enough.
Yeah, it interested me enough. I wanted to find out all the, you know, extraneous color and detail around how they found that out or what the explanation was or whatever. So
the juicy,
it certainly didn't stop me from clicking.
Yeah, the juicy nugget that was revealed was a good nugget. It was something that suggested that the story would be interesting to you.
Right.
Half the time, those kinds of headlines say, you're not going to believe what blah, blah, blah. And when you find out, you're like, that's not even interesting.
Exactly.
It's just dull.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so it can be a tease. But I'd go to Jeff's point on this as well, which is that, you know, without those sorts of Twitter feeds, you might not ever see that article anyway. There's so many articles out there that you never get anywhere near them. And somebody who's subscribing to those types of Twitter feeds, there are several of them out there, and I really like them. You know, you're not going to see those things anywhere else. They're teasing stories you're probably not going to see elsewhere if they are specific to BuzzFeed or whatever.
And bringing it back to Google News, those publishers, just like the ones in Belgium, where the same thing happened, not only will they see traffic decline, but they're missing the point. If the point is to reach more people with your content and convince them that you're smart and you have things that are worth reading, then whether they read that specific article or not isn't really the point. And so, their viewpoint is it's our content, we should control it, and they feel like they already have all the audience they need, so Google's stealing it. You know, that's a completely different way of thinking about kind of what your job is as a newspaper.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to come back and hear about Facebook's apology to, quote, affected drag queens, unquote. We'll find out which drag queens were affected and which were not. But first, I want to tell you about our first sponsor today, which is Citrix GoToMeeting. Of course, good communication is crucial for business. You don't want to leave Jeff Jarvis out of your meeting. And so you want to make sure you use a great tool like Citrix GoToMeeting, enabling you to connect with remote clients, coworkers, and everyone else you want to meet with. Let's face it. There's so much wasted money and time on business travel for meetings that could be done over Citrix GoToMeeting. And so you definitely want to use the proven solution for meeting and collaborating online. If you sign up for GoToMeeting before October 10th, this is an awesome deal. You'll get another Citrix product of your choice free for 6 months. And of course, here on the TWiT Network, we advertise many of these products, and you can take your pick which one you want to get free for 6 months. That is a fantastic deal. GoToMeeting lets you share the same screen so everybody stays on the same page, literally on the same page. And with built-in HD video conferencing, you just need a webcam to see each other face-to-face. GoToMeeting helps your team work smarter from any location and on any computer, tablet, or smartphone. I love the lean-back meeting with my tablet, with my iPad. It's just so fantastic. I look professional, but in fact, I'm wearing my pajama bottoms, and I'm kicking back into bed. I'm very comfortable and enjoying the meeting. Work smarter. Get started with GoToMeeting now. Sign up for GoToMeeting today and get another Citrix product free for 6 months. Visit GoToMeeting.com and get started, but don't wait. This offer ends October 10th. Visit GoToMeeting.com and sign up to receive this special offer today. Well, the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence got a big victory today. The Facebook actually apologized to the effective community of drag queens. I'm going to read the whole apology by Facebook here, the apology part of their message, which is, quote, "I want to apologize to the affected community of drag queens, drag kings, transgender, and extensive community of our friends, neighbors, and members of the LGBT community for the hardship that we've put you through in dealing with your Facebook accounts over the past few weeks." They said they would revisit their real names policy to make it possible for drag queens who have stage names to use those stage names as their name on Facebook. And this sounds to me, I don't know how you all feel about this, but this sounds to me like a complete phony baloney response to this, because basically they're saying if you're a performer and you have a stage name and you use that stage name as your actual name in real life, generally speaking, if you really go by Little Miss Hot Mess, if that's really the name you go by in real life, then you can go ahead and use that on Facebook, and we're going to let you do that. That doesn't sound like it's going to affect. How many people are professional drag queens? I mean, you know, they haven't solved any problem here, but what do you guys think?
Yeah, I have to agree, Mike. I wrote about this when it first happened. I've been a big proponent of anonymity online for a long time, even though I know lots of people blame it for all the world's problems. But I fundamentally believe that allowing people to comment and behave anonymously has value. And so Facebook has always been, to some extent, trying to suck and blow at the same time. They've been trying to say, well, you can use a quote-unquote fake name, but only if that's what you go by in real life. So, as you pointed out, if you're a drag performer and you can say, well, this is what people know me by, if you're effectively a celebrity in some sense, then you can do that. But regular people can't. And so although that community was what sparked this issue, that's not the sum total of the issue, I mean, or the problem. There are lots and lots of users who are trans and gay and fall into all sorts of categories who cannot use the name that they want, and what they get is Facebook asking them for their birth certificate or their driver's license. That, from what I can tell, that is not going to change.
Now, there's a solution that seems kind of obvious to me, and Gina, maybe you can help me with this, because I don't understand why all the social networks don't do this. The solution to me seems to be that if they want to demand real names, and of course, Twitter and Google Plus don't demand real names. Google Plus doesn't anymore. They did for a long time. But why don't they just demand your real name to be privately given to the social network and then allow the public to see your pseudonym? That way they get both the best of both worlds. They know exactly who you are. They can, you can use your account as your identity. You can use it for buying things, you know, all that stuff. But then you never have to reveal it to the public. What's wrong with that solution?
I mean, I think for some communities, particularly imagine, you know, a kindergarten teacher in a very conservative part of, you know, of the country who, you know, is a drag queen performer at night who literally has, you know, is living a double life and doesn't necessarily want to out him or herself. You know, I mean, there are situations. But my legal name, by the way, is Regina McTrapezoid. I just go by Gina Trapani because it's a lot easier here. I mean, this isn't just about drag queens, right? It's about broadcasters and musicians and artists and book, like people who write and use pen names, like. Right. It's about people. And you know, I mean, the real name, I don't even like when people say real name. It's legal name. It's your given name. It's the name that your parents gave you and that's on, you know, a sheet of paper that says you were born, right? But that isn't necessarily who you are. And as far as I'm concerned, like, people should just be able to say, this is how I want you to refer to me, and period. That's real. That's real enough for me. So I don't know, this whole identification thing and your legal name is this. And what if, I don't know, I don't like it.
But there's no technical reason. There's no technical reason, right? I mean,
technical reason. And in fact, this came up during the Google Plus, you know, NIM wars or whatever you want to call them too. There is no technical reason why Facebook couldn't do that. There's a reason why some users might not want to present that name even privately to Facebook, because they don't trust the company to keep that data separate, and they don't trust, you know, they can't trust where that information is going to wind up. But, you know, to me, it feels, and I could be wrong, but it feels to me like Facebook mainly wants you to use your quote unquote real name or given name because that's what advertisers want.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Matthew, but here's the thing that really bugs me is that certain types of names can be used. Pseudonym, you know, I could go to Facebook right now and start an account. I could make up a name and I'd have an account and they'd never know. Mm-hmm. Right. But if that name happens to be Little Miss Hot Mess, they're going to say, well, that doesn't sound right. Or if I have some other outrageous name. So, you know, the vast majority of fake names, there are huge numbers of people on Facebook using fake names without consequence.
Well, right. When you've been reported or someone has marked you as abusive, you know, what's the first thing the police ask you when they pull you over? Show me your ID, right? Like, but that's a way that authorities assert power and you know, show me who you are, show me your credentials. My you know, working on a college campus, first thing you ask a student who's doing something wrong, what, you know, show me your ID. It is a power move. It is kind of a power relationship. And I just don't like, I get that Facebook has this problem where they need to make decisions about whether or not people are actually behaving badly or abusing someone, and getting their actual legal name is some indicator of whether or not this person is for real. I don't know. But I feel like for the majority of Facebook's users, they should be known by how they want to be known, and that should be it.
And to be honest, it feels to me like Facebook, you know, apart from the advertising element or whether that's what advertisers want, they, you know, reading Chris Cox's description of how it happened, they all got lumped in with a bunch of these other reports and someone flagged their accounts maliciously or whatever, and they didn't. It feels to me, and obviously they have a billion users, so this stuff is not simple, but they could do the things we're describing if they wanted to. They could make it easier for people to use pseudonyms. They could structure things so that you could do that and they could still achieve their objectives. They just clearly don't want to, or they don't want to devote the time and resources to making that happen. So that says something about their priorities, I think.
Was there really a mass departure to Elo, or was that just a phony baloney trumped up sort of rumor that people grabbed onto and reported as fact?
Well, they did come at the same time.
I'm using... I can't remember the joke. What's the name of it? What was the name of the other Facebook?
App.net.
App.net. Yeah.
And what else? And
I'm on Diaspora. I'm before that.
Oh, Diaspora. Right. Yeah.
I mean, I had a reporter call me today about this, and I said, I'm dubious of the killers. If you think that you're making a killer, then you're not being creative enough. You're not really inventing something new and of value, and you're not going to kill whatever you think you're killing. And he's not going
to work. It is true that Elo did seem to attract a whole lot of artistic users, I think partly because it was designed and created by designers. And so they reached out to friends in the creative community. I don't feel like there was a huge influx of people running away from Facebook.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Some people started Elo accounts, but they didn't close their Facebook account. So what's the point?
I mean,
eventually they'll be annoyed by Elo because it's pretty hard to use, I think, for the most part. And they'll just gravitate back to where people are that they know. And that's the thing that enables Facebook to get away with all this kind of stuff, which is that they have a monopoly on everybody. Everybody's on Facebook because everybody's on Facebook, and you have to be there if you want to interact with the people you know. And that's the bottom line. And they can harass you. They can violate your privacy. They can lie to you. They can censor your news feed. They can do anything they want. And nobody, you know, for the most part, most people aren't going to leave. There are reasons people leave. Sometimes they leave because they're not sure about the privacy policy, so they go to Snapchat or whatever, so they can have these conversations that are definitely private. But people don't leave because of this kind of stuff.
Well, and you know, what Gina said, I think brings up a good point. And the sort of free speech implications of Facebook and Twitter and other platforms are, I find, fascinating, because effectively our sort of public square, our digital public square, has been privatized. And so we have a whole bunch of shopping malls where you can go and wave signs around and say whatever you want and behave the way you want until the mall cops come and say, you have to get out of here, because they own that building. And so, you know, all of these decisions that places like Facebook make, as sort of minor as they might seem, are effectively laws for this sort of social space that we, as you pointed out, pretty much have to belong to. And so all of those decisions have real world implications, and social and political and sort of behavioral implications.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. With Elo, I mean, what was interesting to me about Elo is just that I think there was a huge spike in Elo registrations and hype and media, and it was getting talked up a lot. I don't think that people were leaving Facebook, but Elo's whole value proposition was, we're not Facebook. Mm-hmm. We're not going to sell you ads. We're going to treat you like a human being and not a set of eyeballs. And so it was interesting to me that people responded to that. But this has happened so many times. People responded to that with Diaspora, and they raised what was back then on Kickstarter, a ton of money. People responded to this with app.net and paid $50, you know, subscription fees. Like, this is something that resonates with users, particularly savvy users. It means something. I think there's a whole group of, you know, I think there's an ardent group of people hoping that one of these either federated or anti-Facebook, not Facebook networks will actually prevail in the end. I don't know if they actually will, but there's interest here. So that interests me as
there's a continual sort of need or hunger or desire for something else, for something that sort of treats you like a human being. And it just keeps emerging from time to time under a different name. The thing I notice is certainly my daughters, who are, you know, in their early 20s, teens, have no interest in Facebook and never go there. So what they're using are completely other networks for other reasons, in many cases because they offer different forms of privacy or anonymity. You know, Facebook is non-existent for them.
That's interesting.
Well, speaking of young people using social media, Google announced today that Google Plus now has a new setting, a new feature that enables you to designate your profile as for adults only. You can basically, it's an audience editing tool on Google Plus. It lets you set filters based on age and location. So you can actually zero in and say, you know, this is only for people in certain locations. And this helps companies comply with local laws around this sort of thing. But it seems to me that they're paving the way for enabling maybe a little bit more freedom about what sort of content you can put on Google Plus. Because if you can age restrict it, then you can go ahead and have more adult-like content that may be in the future less likely to be censored. Right now, there's, you know, any sort of anything that's more than PG-13, I think they pretty much, not language-based, you can pretty much say anything, but for pictures and that sort of thing, anything above PG-13, they will block you, or they'll, you know, take you out of the system or whatever. Is this a good idea? I mean, and also, one of the criticisms that's being leveled against this is that you can't designate individual posts as being either adults only or not. You can only say everything that I do is for adults only, or nothing I do is for adults only. But what do you guys think about this?
This is similar to, doesn't Twitter have a setting where you can say mark my media as private or sensitive? Yeah. And I think it applies to all of your tweets. So then if you attach an image or whatever, it's collapsed by default. This is interesting. I hadn't seen this. So why? So okay. Age, I get. Why would you restrict your Google Plus posts to a particular geographic area?
No idea. Possibly. I mean, maybe if you know, if you have local laws that you're concerned with, if you're in a certain mm-hmm. community and you have mm-hmm. a business in that community, and there's a law for that area or that country or that county or whatever it is, you can comply, I guess, and it doesn't apply outside. I'm not really sure. I haven't played with these. Right.
Let's say you're a German publisher, for example.
Yeah, for example. Yeah.
Right. Or a marijuana dispensary.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. All right. Okay.
So to check this out, you go to your Google Plus profile settings. I haven't done this myself, but these are the instructions posted online. And you select the audience tab. Again, this is Google Plus profile settings, audience tab, and it'll open a variety of preset and customizable post filters, and you can choose these new filters that are in there now. So that's a kind of an interesting new
turn. I wonder if they were getting criticism for, you know, age inappropriate content showing up in people's streams or something. This doesn't feel like a feature like that lots of people would be crying out for.
Well, yeah. You know, their algorithmic filtering is so horrible. If you go to your notifications, I mean, my notifications is 50% fine and 50%, what are you giving me? Why are you giving me this? It's like somebody in some other country just saying, hey, and it's a picture of themselves like standing in a parking lot. And out of all the users on Google Plus, this is what you've determined. Yeah. Your algorithms have determined that I really want. It's crazy. But sometimes you're going through that filter and I'm just like, whoa, all of a sudden. It's quite inappropriate. And
so it's to make up for the fact that their filters can't do that already,
I guess.
right. Mike, are you still, is Google Plus still your sort of primary writing platform? I know that you've been really bullish and very active on Google Plus for a long time.
You have like 2 million followers or something. You're in 2 million circles or something.
I do. It's still growing. It's still growing at about 2,000 per day, which is pretty crazy.
Wow.
It's very active. It's my primary. For a long time, it was my exclusive social network. But since I've been at Twit, I am using Twitter and some other things because I got to go where the whole audience is now.
Did you write full things on Google Plus? Was that a strategy that you used in the beginning, or?
I tested that. I wrote a few columns. What I did was I had some circles of editors and other people who had volunteered, and I basically did my drafts there, and they, you know, I had people commenting and stuff. It was pretty cool. But I don't do that anymore for the most part. I do use it for crowdsourcing. I use it for all kinds of stuff, and I do really like it a lot. I just find the conversation so good there, and I have zero trolls. Zero. I mean, you know, that's not exactly true. I never encounter trolls more than once. And when I encounter them, I block them and I never hear from them again. And it's just fantastic for that purpose. And I love it for that purpose. And I also like the fact that it's got a clean user interface. I still like all that stuff and I like all the people there. I've actually made real friends on Google Plus, which is one of the rare things that you can do with a social network. Met them in person,
you know what,
and all that kind of stuff.
I mean, I've had an account for a long time and I post content there, lots of, not just my own posts, but photos and whatnot. I'm in lots of circles, 300,000 or something, and I post things there and I get nothing. I might get like one comment.
Yeah,
I get so best. I'm obviously doing something wrong.
Am I on?
Yeah, you are. Go ahead,
Jeff.
Yeah,
you are.
I was off for a while, so sorry. That's weird because I've actually been abusing Google Plus lately. I haven't used it as much as I should, but I tend to get comments. I tend to get stuff.
I'm just
horde.
Not that interesting.
Yeah, the horde on Google Plus is an odd creature. They respond to certain things and don't respond to others, it's just amazing. And one of the things they respond to is heavy use and primary use. So if you were to use Google Plus as your primary place where you're posting things, all the stuff that you post on Twitter, which is all great stuff, if you were to do that every day after a few weeks, they would start gathering and you'd get this buildup of momentum.
Yeah, I guess it's just not a repeat. You know, I do it from time to time, but it's not regular activity. And you know what? I would probably do it more if Google had an open API where I could use third-party tools to post to it.
Yeah. And that's really the solution that I think most people don't. I think we need a big movement of people calling for interoperability between the social networks, because right now it's considered, first of all, socially unacceptable to sort of auto post using various tools. People hate cross posting for some reason. I actually think it's better than everybody living in their own little individual silos, and also it's better than having to spend all your time chasing down conversations on all these multiple things. It'd be great to have one
conversation. People see it as spam, I guess.
Yeah,
I know Kevin Marks yelled at me for cross-posting once.
But it's actually a good solution if you do it right. The way I do it is I use Friends Plus Me. And so on Twitter, it works great. Facebook doesn't work so great. But on Twitter...
Use what?
It's called Friends Plus Me, the plus sign and then me.com. It's just a tool. You just enact it. And then everything you post on Google Plus goes to Twitter with a link. So essentially the first line of what you post, which I tend to use as a headline, it's a perfect tweet and it gives you a perfect link. And that link goes back to Google Plus. And so I actually am inviting Twitter users to come to Google Plus and have a conversation with the Google Plus people. It's one conversation. I have to manage one place. And it's a great solution. And I think when people complain to me that I'm cross-posting, it's like, why is that? Why is cross posting better than
that's home delivery, Mike?
Exactly.
That's going where
exactly.
the people are. That's okay.
Yeah, I agree.
So when I was at speaking to the work people, I held up my Chromebook and that alone got applause. And I said, I take about as much crap for this as I do for liking Google Plus, and that also got a laugh.
That's a good one. All right, that must have done well in a room full of Googlers.
I did. By the way, there were 250 Googlers in the room, and so I was talking about somehow Twig came up, of course. And so I said, "How many of you watch Twig?" And a good, I'd say, third raised their hands. And then I said, "Uh-oh, what if it's only Googlers watching?"
Right. How many employees do they have, and how many is one third of those employees?
Yeah.
Just as long as they're patronizing our sponsors.
That's fine. Yes,
that's right.
Get them to open up the Google Plus API.
All right, so we got another story coming out of Europe, and Jeff, I'm going to defer to your pronunciation. Is it Günther Oettinger? How did
Oettinger.
I do? Yeah, so he's the
Oettinger.
Yeah, thank you. He's the new EU commissioner who admitted Monday that he's the one who derailed the settling of an antitrust investigation against Google.
Well, there's a lot of people trying to take credit for that now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he is a politician. And he said that if I hadn't been opposed to it, the Google case would have been settled back in March. And then now they're saying that there's fresh evidence and solid arguments from 20 formal complaints persuading them that Google needs to present a better settlement offer. This, of course, is around the whole issue of Google providing information that competes against their competitors. I don't know. And this is related, of course, to the focus on the user campaign. And
it's the same. It's not a user campaign at all. It's the publishers. It's actual Springer and Company. Uh-huh. Same exact people. They've run this campaign. They've run big ads and papers. They've brought in News Corp, which we talked about the Robert Thompson letter 2 weeks ago, they're making Google into the big enemy. And so they derailed. They succeeded in derailing this agreement. Now what's troubling about that is I watched on Twitter. And then translated as best I could tweets from the newspaper conference in Germany 2 days ago. And you had Angela Merkel, the chancellor, going and paying homage and regretting how they've lost their newsrooms and what a shame this is. You have the head of the SPD, the left party in the Bundestag, coming forward and saying that we have to contain Google's market power. You have the justice minister of the country previously, as we've talked about in the show, calling for Google to be broken up. And Google's been, frankly, sitting there, either being silent or, according to a friend of mine, a bit rude and haughty. And they haven't found at all the right way to have this discussion. And it's going to damage not just Google. Our big fear is it's going to damage the net. This is spreading from Germany. We have the tax on links being proposed in Spain. We have the right to be forgotten. Techno-Euro panic is spreading, and it's going to have a huge impact on the net. So now you have, at the EC... person in charge of this replaces somebody who was actually pretty forward-thinking in most ways, Neelie Kroes. Oettinger is now the head, and he's bragging about how he's all for the right to be forgotten. He's bragging about how he sided with the publishers to kill the settlement that had already been made in the EU. You have German politicians in the pocket of these media companies. The politicians they're supposed to be covering, instead they're running to these politicians to get help with their failed businesses. It's a really sucky situation there.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And sometimes I, in my moments of darkness, I wonder whether the Europeans just want to shake down American tech companies for the money. I mean, in this case,
well, certainly, Mike, that's absolutely of the publishers. I have heard them chortle and giggle about this. They're smart people. They know better. They know that Google's not going to pay them 11% of their revenue for linking to them. I mean, how stupid can you be? They're not that stupid. When Matthias Dufter, the head of Springer, argues that he's scared of Google, I don't believe that for a second. They're laughing, thinking we got Google over the barrel, but there's unintended consequences galore here. And when I talked to IFA in Germany, I argued this is going to hurt Germany badly. Would you invest in Germany right now? I sure as hell would not. I would not. If I were a tech company, I'd get as far away from there as I possibly could. And it's just at the time that the Berlin startup scene has taken off. What I heard when I was in Berlin is that you can only get angel money in Germany because Germans don't want to risk anything more of their capital for these startups. So what happens is the VCs in America come after the good ones and they make a move to the U.S. or they buy them and make them come to the U.S. So this atmosphere is going to cause a brain drain in Germany just when it most needs the ability to grow its technology world. Now, what Google should do, I think, is actually counterintuitive here. It should invest like crazy in German technology so it's not alone trying to argue against the Luddites. Right now, Google's alone as the boogeyman enemy against failing institutions that have not figured out how to adapt to the new world. And government and publishers are in an unholy alliance together. And it's ugly. Sorry for the rant, but hey, that's me.
Matthew Ingram, what do you think?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with Jeff. It feels to me like just a plain old revenue grab. And it feels a lot like countries. I'm not as informed about the sort of internal politics as Jeff in Germany. But I do know that in lots of European countries, they are afraid because their economies are weak. They have no real startup sort of, you know, ecosystem going. And they're afraid, to be honest, of large American web companies like Google and Facebook. And so I think they see them as they see these types of laws as a way of asserting some control over them and potentially generating some revenue. That's what it feels like to me.
Is this a German cultural thing? I mean, it reminds me of the beer purity laws, Jeff, where basically they have these very stringent requirements for what can be put into beer. And Germany has fantastic beer, but the variety that they have in Germany is sort of they're behind the times in terms of the crazy experimentation that's going on in the rest of the world. Is this a German cultural thing? I mean, they have a lot of public support for these sort of sentiments there, don't they?
No, actually they don't.
They don't.
Keep in mind, this is very important. Google has its second highest market share in Germany as anywhere in the world. And so it's
93%, right?
63% in the U.S. So a full, you know, let me get my math right here, half higher than the U.S. That's gigantic, which is to say that the German user likes Google and has no problem and uses them. It's this campaign by publishers and government. But perception can become reality. And it's going to become reality if Google doesn't figure out the right way to fight back yet, and they haven't figured it out. They're either silent or haughty, and that's not the right thing to do.
Yeah. And to be honest, I think the whole NSA thing hurt a lot of
Absolutely.
Big American web companies. I mean, Google said we have nothing to do with this, and meanwhile, there's all these reports about, you know, the FBI or whoever, NSA tapping cables and putting boxes in their colos, and so everybody, I think, just got nervous about what was happening to their data when they were using these companies.
Yeah, and that reminds me of the, you mentioned the NSA. There was a story that we don't have on the doc here this morning, but I'll just mention it briefly, which is that Eric Holder, who's, the Attorney General of the United States, gave a speech yesterday where he was essentially throwing Apple and Google under the bus because of their strong encryption. And he was speaking in front of a group of people who were gathered together to protect children from predators, online predators, sexual predators, kidnappers, and other threats that some children face. And he was, you know, it was a kind of a think of the children kind of a speech. And these dirty, rotten Silicon Valley companies are adding this encryption that prevents police and the FBI from successfully prosecuting criminals and predators. And, you know, it really bugged me because this new encryption movement is a reaction to the NSA and unconstitutional mass surveillance by.
But that's fit, that fits their argument, though. The whole argument is you need to let us spy on you at all times because you or someone you know may be doing something bad. And so we need to install cameras in your house and, you know, suck in all your data because you might be doing something bad. You could be trading child porn, or you could be thinking about joining ISIS. And so we need...
You could be. But this is the real right to be forgotten. This is the right for you to crumple
to
up your
private.
Own piece of paper, to erase your own file. That's still a right, and that's still the essence of privacy is what I control. And when you lose control over the government, every time I go to Europe, I apologize for being an American with the NSA. It's abhorrent what the NSA has done, and it needs control. And I think that encrypting everybody. When I was at Google, I said, screw the government in this case. Who's your daddy here? It's your users. And you've got to enable encryption of everything, or else people aren't going to trust you.
That was the most perfect segue for our next conversation, which is the Focus on the User campaign. If you haven't seen this, it's an organization that's going after Google. It's an organization comprised of Google's competitors, Yelp, TripAdvisor, HolidayCheck, and others. And they created this amazing video. It's actually a really great video. Let's go ahead and roll that.
When the internet was first getting off the ground, its information was overwhelming. No one knew how to access the data, so it wasn't very helpful. Then Google came along. Organizing the world's information, they made it universally accessible and useful through an algorithm. This formula looked through all the information and helped sort it out and present it to users in the way we've all come to appreciate. This changed everything. How we did business and relationships. How we accessed information. Even how information was provided. And once the most relevant sources were being rewarded and delivered to the user, people came to depend on these results and lean upon Google's stated goal of focusing on users, which led to one of the biggest evolutions of Google search when Google started to deliver more specific results in the form of answers. Instead of just links to sites, Google started looking at other types of information.
Knowledge base,
using
Google Now, etc.
Algorithms, right. It sorted through the information of the
knowledge
world
graph.
To try and deliver the actual answer you were looking for. Sometimes
How
this came in the form of a location on a map, a weather forecast, or even the answer to a math question. And because Google was consistently delivering information that was most
make a compelling
to the
argument
user,
in a couple of in about a minute or so.
But lately, there have been some concerns. Google has started to further change the way it's displaying search, and people are starting to take note. Instead of running info through their standard organic search algorithm, Google has started giving preferential treatment to some of its own content to boost its popularity.
It's graphic.
Now, when users see results, some of them are still what's most helpful, but some are just what Google wants you to see. And here's the thing, they look the same. Even though the results that come through the back door have not had to go through the trusted algorithm. These selective and biased results omit some of the best information that is available on the web, making it more difficult for users to find what they are looking for and discouraging the innovation of those providing good information. So what was once a trusted platform to find relevant answers is now being questioned because if it's not being done in the best interest of the user, who is it valuable for? Right now, Google is being investigated because the interests of users, institutions, and businesses that have come to depend on Google are being threatened. The solution? For regulators, Google, innovators, and most importantly, users, is for Google to start acting more like Google. That's what it means to focus on the user. Allow the best, unbiased results on the first page without giving preference to Google Plus or anyone else. The trust of users, the health and innovation of business ecosystems, and the rights of everyone to have access to information depend on it. You can protect the integrity of search. Download Focus on the User Local to see examples of the unbiased results that are possible. Share this message and contact members of the European Commission. We can keep the internet honest by helping Google continue to focus on the user.
That's that. What do you think, Jeff? That sounds reasonable.
Well, hold on. No, yeah, no, it doesn't.
Keep the internet honest, really?
For a couple of reasons. One,
back to the trusted algorithm.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Sorry, really. Who says that? Does it? Okay, fine. If fair is fair, then if Google is required to link to Yelp in some formula, then does Yelp require to link to Google? I have the same problem with the German publishers. They made a video very similar, kind of, oh, this is cute. We're going to make it all seem so cute and make you understand, you idiots, video, in which they said, go search for shoes on Google, and my God, they show you their advertisers. Well, now go to Bilt, the largest publication in Europe owned by Axel Springer. See that there's a little link on top for Schuhe, in shoes. What do you see there? You see Bilt's advertisers and nothing else. What do you see on Google? You see their advertisers, of course, and you see the rest of everything you can possibly want about shoes. I just searched on hotels in Madrid, because I'm going there soon, on Google. At the top, I see their ads. I see ads and sponsored things. It's clearly labeled. A lot of ads. Google's selling a lot of ads because there's a lot of demand for it. That's true. But I don't see that there's what they were accused of doing in that video was presenting algorithmic listings and paid listings looking exactly the same. Show me how. That says ad. That says ad. That says sponsored. On the right, it says ads. So show me how that's true, and then maybe you convinced me, but I don't see it. Right below there is TripAdvisor. First listing, TripAdvisor.
There's a – and it, is it – does it also disable their point to a certain extent, invalidate their point to a certain extent, that these are just competitors who are trying to compete right. by essentially changing public opinion, which is, I guess, the definition of propaganda?
Well, no, they're not trying to change public opinion. They're trying to change policy opinion. They're trying to hide behind government. This is the great irony of News Corp and Axel Springer fighting this, because they are both conservative bastions of conservative thinking, don't like big government, have been awfully critical of the EU. When they can't make their business work, what do? They run behind the skirt of the EU government. Gina, you were trying to say something a minute ago, and I interrupted. This is my bad habit.
No, that's okay. No, it was just interesting to me that the video had this concept of like there was a trusted Google and now there's not a trusted Google. Right. And can we just get back to the trusted algorithm?
Good old Google before they had
this. Whoever yeah. trusted the algorithm.
Right. It's like, exactly. No, this is the algorithm. And also weird that Google Plus, I never see Google Plus results and search results. I very rarely do I see Google. I found that interesting that Google Plus was the thing that got plugged into the machine and was stuffing results. Mm. I mean, mm-hmm. I got to tell you, I just ran the search for hotels in Madrid. This is on my 15-inch MacBook. And partially because this big image bar across the top, like, the actual results that aren't ads are below the fold. Like, mm-hmm. I actually do have yeah. to scroll in order to get to that first TripAdvisor.
The images take up a lot.
The images mm-hmm. do take up a lot. And those are not sponsored as far as I can tell. Those that's just oh, a, that's just
are.
An image.
I think they're commerce links, aren't they?
The images?
Are they or not?
It's just encrypted.google.com.
Well, filtered by rating. Who's rating? I wonder. Oh, that's a good question.
That could be Google Plus. That could be Google Local, which is, you know, remember the Zagat guys. Yeah. Yep.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, okay.
And it's also in Maps, so it's the same
right,
database.
Right, and Maps is Maps is taking up a chunk on the right there, which is just a useful search result. Most of my searches don't look anything like this. This happens to be a very highly sold search results. But anyway, yeah, no, that the video is just interesting. I mean, are users complaining? It sounds like the publishers are the ones who are complaining. Yes. You know, like this idea that this is about the users, right? Like, I don't know.
Well,
and be careful. Those other tech companies, be careful, because they're going to come after you next.
Yeah.
Your American tech companies, and you're being demonized, and so you play in with their hand, and they're going to turn right back around and say, oh, you have to link to our stuff, or we're going to come after you and ask you for money for links. Watch out.
Yeah.
Well, and the only possible solution is that Google is somehow regulated and forced to rank links in a specific way. That is the only other option to allowing Google to do whatever its algorithm or, you know, its desire to place ads tells it to do.
Unless you accept their argument that there's no visual difference between, and I'm not sure that's exactly true, but if there in fact is no visual difference between their, you know, in, you know, Google Plus result and the what would be the natural result, then that's one option. But I agree with you. Sure. That's not what they want. That's
you
not what they want.
There has to be a flag. But then they said some good results are not being included, and then you see the result drop out of the list. So then Google would have to be required to have a certain number of links to a certain number of external sites within a certain, you know, and then you've got a Google regulator.
And that's implies that there's a tiny number of of other companies that are going to be privileged. They can't add results from every single company that provides hotel information.
It's a recipe for disaster.
Right, exactly.
Oh, absolutely.
And by the way, the best source of recommendations is person to person. So, Jeff, I'm going to give you a recommendation. The very best pizza place in the world is in Madrid.
Oh.
You got to go to this place. The guy's Italian, and he's a recent immigrant to Spain, but it's called Pizza Teca. And it's
what a perfect name for you to like, yeah.
Exactly, but it's Teca is spelled T-E-C-A, and the URL is La Pizza Teca, and it's just the most fantastic pizza I have ever tasted in my life.
You would know, man, with an oven in your backyard.
Exactly, right. The guy ferments his dough for 3 days, and then he adds yeast at the end. Ooh. He told me it's something he learned from his grandmother. Mm. Anyway, it's a great restaurant. But back to the tech news. In just a sec, we're going to come back. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about, I don't know, maybe Julian Assange and some of his comments about Google and Eric Schmidt's response and so on. But first, I want to tell you about Personal Capital. Personal Capital is a good service. It's one of our sponsors today, and it's good because money is good, and it's good for you to hang on to the money that you've earned, and they help you do that. One of the ways they help you do that is right now we've all got our financial stuff scattered all over the world, on different sites, in different financial companies, in banks, 401ks, all over the place. And Personal Capital is really cool because it brings together all that data it puts it together. So it shows your money, what's coming in, what's going out, and it lumps it together in a way that's very intuitive and easy to understand. And I really appreciate that. I also like the fact that they have an Android Wear application, or an Android application that supports Android Wear, I guess is more accurate. They were one of the first companies to support Android Wear. And I had been using this app, I don't know, for about 3 hours. And I got a message saying that, you know, I had some kind of a fee that was going to be charged against my bank account if I didn't take action. I took action. I avoided a $35 fee within the first few hours. And that's essentially what this free app does. It saves you money. And it shows you your money so you can make better investment decisions. So it's really a great thing. There's no reason not to use Personal Capital. Set up your free account. Go to personalcapital.com/twig. And Personal Capital is free, and it's a smart way to grow your money. And we thank Personal Capital for their support of This Week in Google. Well, Vanity Fair has a big article about I don't know if you guys saw this, but it was a Julian Assange did a kind of Obi-Wan Kenobi type of hologram interview where he was basically going after Google and saying that Google was the NSA or working with the NSA, and quite an interesting thing. I don't know. We didn't queue up a video of that, Chad, but if you can find that, it's in actually in one of the story links there. Very bizarre. Let's take a look at this.
Or has presented over the last 10 years of being some fluffy graduate student, colorful, like its logo, a playroom of ideas, and a different sort of company, not even a company at all, something that gives free services. It's not that. It's a normal company, just like other normal companies in the US that are very big. And it should be seen as a normal company. Unlike other companies, however, it is engaged in a very ambitious project that is not normal in terms of its business, and that is to collect as much information about the world as is possible, store it, index it, make predictive models about people's interests, and use that to sell advertising. And of course, the National Security Agency comes along, given that Google is doing basically what the National Security Agency is doing in terms of collecting information, storing it, indexing it, and attaching it to people, and sticks its fangs in and sucks the information that Google sucks. And that's going to be the case, or no matter what Google does, unless it leaves the U.S. jurisdiction.
Now, I'm probably in the minority, but I actually love advertising. I think it's the most moral form of monetization for most online services, and I'll tell you why. Because basically, those people who use the advertisements and buy the products and services advertised subsidize the services for everybody, including people who can't afford it. This is especially true with social networks and so on, and that's why I don't like any sort of social network that charges admission, like app.net. I was kind of against that service. And of course, contextual advertising in principle is a great thing, because who wants, I don't want to see ads for wrinkle cream, and maybe I need it, but I don't want to see those ads. I don't want to see irrelevant advertisement. I want to see relevant advertisement. I want it to be so relevant that it feels like I'm getting search results for things I would have searched for if I had a thought of it. And of course, that's, to me, that's the big problem with Google and Facebook and everybody else who claims to harvest our personal data for the sake of serving up contextual advertising, in that they don't know how to do it well, in my experience. I think they're terrible at it. I don't really understand why. But anyway, what do we think of Julian? Of course, he's in the Ecuadorian embassy in London still, and that's why he had to be beamed in. What do you think of his comments there?
I can't stop focusing on that. I'm just thinking that I'm going to cancel all my airplane tickets, yeah. And I'm hologramming in everywhere.
I got to admit, that is awesome. Like, that
it
looks
was
amazing.
Weird.
That looks amazing. I would do that.
Didn't
new
CNN try that?
Sit in your living room and get beamed in by holograms. It's fantastic. Right.
It's a high-res 3D version of what we're doing here,
Amazing. Basically. Amazing.
That is fantastic. But he's been trading barbs with Eric Schmidt because they both have books, essentially. And I don't know. I haven't
read. Did you read the vignette that he mentions, that Julian Assange mentions in his book about Eric Schmidt? Eric Schmidt's girlfriend came to see him. And
no.
Was effectively, his allegations, as I recall them, are that he was talking with someone about the government, about the NSA, that type of stuff, about WikiLeaks, and he got a visit from Eric Schmidt's girlfriend and someone from the State Department, or I think it might have been Jared Cohen, anyway, someone who was either associated with or had been associated with the State Department. So his allegation is that effectively Eric Schmidt is a couple of steps away from being a government operative, which, you know, is the type of thing that Julian Assange likes to say. I don't know if I believe that, but certainly his claims in the video that Google is a business, well, clearly it is a business. Clearly it is trying to gain as much information about its users as possible. That seems pretty, I have no problem agreeing with that.
Yeah, it's all very weird. And that vignette, I had not heard that, but that is very strange, and it's quite a leap. I mean, some people have worked for the State Department. I don't think that necessarily means that Eric Schmidt is. And besides, why would he work for the government? He's got a much better job than anybody in the government, including the president, if you ask me.
It's true.
Kind of a weird type of deal. Well, Google's getting into the streaming music service business. They've upped the ante on their music business. These are based on essentially rumors that Google's going to be unveiling another streaming service, and they're going to. We had a conversation on this on Tech News today, and the big question was, why does Google torture itself and torture us with all these different sources of music? They've got YouTube, they've got Google Play Music, they've got all these different things. Why don't they just have one kind of iTunes thing or one Spotify-oriented service and just let everybody buy into that?
I don't think they
because
actually
that's not
know
how they
what
operate.
People want. Right. I don't think
right,
they actually know what people
out.
Want. Yeah, so they're trying a bunch of different things. Those projects probably don't even talk to each other.
Yeah, what people want is Spotify, essentially. Spotify has, I think, 20 times the audience that Google's music service does. I happen to think that the secret is in YouTube somehow. They need to turn YouTube into not just a place where people have videos, and people use it for the music heavily, but they don't have a good way to use the music on YouTube legally. As a music service that just downloads as an audio-only file that streams and has thumbs up and all that kind of stuff, like Pandora or something like that. But I think they could do that. They should do that. I think they're just lost in the woods. They've got so much complexity. I think if we went out on the street and asked people about Google's various music offerings, people would just be super confused about it.
You know, I will say, since I live in Kanakistan and we get things 3 or 4 years later, We just got Google Play Music relatively recently. And so I signed up and I uploaded everything I have basically to Google's cloud. And then I've been using it on various devices. And I have to say, I really like it. I don't have access to a bunch of things that other people do, like Pandora, for example. But I think it is actually pretty good. And they're, in particular, their music recommendations, since we were just talking about their ability to recommend things, I actually think they're pretty good. They've clearly gone through my stuff and they suggest things that are more often than not pretty good to listen to. So I don't know.
It's a great service. It really is. And the quality of the audio seems really good to me. Mm-hmm. Could be my imagination. Maybe it's just because I like the price and that makes it sound better. But I think the audio quality sounds really good. Well, we've got a story here for Jeff. Basically, what people have been saying about the Chromebook and slamming it is, oh, you can't do real work on it. Well, now Photoshop is coming to the Chromebook. Yeah, so now if you can do Photoshop on the Chromebook, what can't you do? Anything?
Video editing, but we've talked about that before. There are services where you can do video editing.
YouTube.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's like, I don't know. This is more of a symbolic victory, I think, for Chromebook fans than anything else, because, of course, you know, you can do 100% of what the majority of people do with a laptop on a Chromebook. Jeff, you and I know that. But people will say things like, hey, can't do real work like Photoshop, and now Photoshop is coming to the Chromebook.
Caveat here, I think it goes just to those who have a subscription to Adobe's suite.
Oh, it's still hideously overpriced. I mean, we're talking about Photoshop, but that's part of the Photoshop experience, is they're going to empty your wallet. So,
feature zero.
Exactly. Exactly.
Empty the wallet.
I did say when I was with the work group that I helped my Chromebook, and I said that you still got to find the middle, and I think robust hardware matters. That if people really get involved with Chromebooks and really start to live on the cloud, and you have friends and neighbors who are doing it and can do it, that's going to drive more people to your services. And so the hardware strategy, as odd as it seemed, I think is actually very important.
Yeah,
I think they need a little bit of sexy, too. I don't know if you agree, but if there was a sort of MacBook Air-looking device and it was a Chromebook, mm-hmm. I would be on that like a fat kid on an M&M. Like, it would be because I love the Chromebook cloud. Everything I use is in the cloud. If I'm not connected to the internet, I'm basically not really doing anything except playing solitaire. But if the design was a little bit better, you know, just a little bit, then I think that would make a big difference for a lot of people.
You are so right. In fact, I was on the fence after testing Chromebook Pixel for a while. I was on the fence between a MacBook Pro with Retina and a Chromebook Pixel as my sole laptop. And that's exactly what brought me over to the MacBook Pro with Retina. It's just the design is better.
It's just so good. Better.
Yeah, it's so good. And if this thing, and I decided that I was going to use it like a Chromebook, I was going to try to be as cloudy as possible with the MacBook Pro, but I ended up getting sucked into all these other things simply because it's there and it's kind of how you do it. But yeah, man, give me a Chromebook that's like a MacBook, even in the ballpark of having the elegance and the lightness and the usability, and I'm there. Although admittedly, the Chromebook Pixel is it's close. It's so close.
It's pretty
a high quality device. The screen
close.
Is beautiful.
Yeah, the Pixel is a nice machine. Yeah. I'm just too married to my. I realize that I'm just really married to my like routines and the ways that I do things. And I've invested some time and money into software, particular bits of software that have certain shortcuts. And like, so I have two things about the Chromebook. Like, I probably could get it all set up so I could do my development and push to Git and run my tests and do all the things that I normally do during the day while I'm coding. I probably could. Just the thought of letting go of like my favorite text editor and like the commands that I use and like having to learn a whole nother thing, you know, I'm like, oh, so, you know, so much time, it would take so much time. In addition, the other point, which I brought up in the past in our discussion of the Chromebook, is like, you know, if someone hacks my Google account, or if my Google account gets shut down for whatever reason and I can't get in touch with anybody at Google, and then like I can't use my computer, that's just not acceptable.
Yeah, no, that's,
you know,
true.
If they shut down my Google account, I couldn't use my Android phone, right? Like, you can't use your Android phone basically unless you're logged in. I changed my, or I was setting up two-factor auth, so I turned it off and turned it back on, and like my phone was just like boop 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 boop. I got all these notifications that I gotten logged out of Play Services, and you know, the whole thing was just sort of rendered. And I was like, oh, this is actually, everything's connected to my Google account, which is a free account on Google. You know, a company that we know. It's not like you can call up and be like, hi, can you unlock me? You know,
you could do that, Gina.
I mean, maybe I could because I have this amazing platform, I would do it. You'd be a twit special, me sort of begging.
But it is funny how your first comment about how you get so used to your workflow, or your, even if it's not in your case, but probably in mine, if it's screwed up in some way, or you've kind of hacked together mm-hmm. some kludgy kind of way of doing things, you're just so used to it. It's like, and so moving to something new, even if it's arguably more efficient or better, it's right. like moving houses or something, or being, you know, uprooted and having to move to a different city, and you don't know where the coffee shop is, and you don't know how to use the bus, or, and it may actually right. turn out to be better, but getting used to it is hard.
Although it has to be said, and I think, Jeff, also you can verify this, there's a psychology that is causing resistance to living in the cloud with a Chromebook. And that psychology is something along the lines of, I know where it is. It's right here. Right. It's right mine.
I made that exact
control
point
it.
At this meeting. And I said,
it's in my hands.
It may sound stupid to you guys, but you've got to provide backup. And I said, we discussed this for like an hour on Twig.
And local device backup?
This will go away. But you need to do it now. You need to provide an API to back up on other virtual services and onto hard drives and such.
Absolutely. And it's exactly the kind of thing that Google is in a position to provide very easily. They just offered unlimited cloud storage with individual file sizes of no bigger than 5 terabytes for the education users. They got all the storage in the world, and they should absolutely just throw the switch and make that happen. But the point I was going to make was that when you actually use a Chromebook, significantly, the psychology reverses. And and when you go back to a regular laptop, you're like, this feels really flimsy to have it right here in my possession. I don't know exactly what's happening on the Chromebook. You always have this sort of peace of mind. I'm not going to get a virus. I know exactly where my stuff is, no matter what device I access my stuff is. I know I'm going to get the current version. The peace of mind is actually in favor of the Chromebook when you start using one.
I actually felt that way even though I don't use a Chromebook. I mean, I'm so connected. Everything I do is on the web. Even when I'm writing, it's WordPress, my own server version, but it's not on the device. And I thought I had lost my laptop. I left it somewhere. I thought, it's gone. Someone's going to have taken it. And you know what? I didn't even care because there's nothing on there. And there's certainly nothing on there that isn't backed up somewhere. Yeah. So, you know, at worst, someone sees a few of my photos. I don't even care. I could have literally bought a new laptop and instantly had all the same stuff I had before.
What about your naked selfies? You're not concerned about that?
Yeah, that stuff I have encrypted.
So okay.
The thing that bothers me, and maybe this bothers me because I know a little too much about how this all works, it's this idea that there's this like single point of failure, this idea of like, you know, like back in college, there was a mainframe, then there were all these dumb terminals, right? And like the dumb terminals could come and go and get connected, but if something's wrong with the mainframe, you couldn't get to it. And that's kind of what Google is. Whereas, you know, I'm a coder, so I work with Git, which is a distributed version control system. That means that on every single machine or device where you're interacting with the repository, there is a full synchronized copy. It's distributed and it's federated. And I can push to this server, I can push to that computer, I can push to that server. So there's no one single point of failure that someone other than me is controlling that I'm dependent upon. And so that distributed, federated, you know, completely synchronized peer-to-peer model, like, just doesn't exist with commercial web apps because they're just not financially incentivized to do that. There's literally no reason for companies to do this, and this is the conversation we've had about diaspora and Twitter and interactivity between the social networks. It actually slows down innovation and means you know, lots of arguments about standards, and it's all really hard. But like, developers, who I think in a lot of ways are kind of the canary in the coal mine, figured out that version control systems that involve this singular canonical copy where developers check out and then push back into it, and there are all these conflicts, and if the server goes down, you're all out of luck.
Incredibly risky.
That doesn't work. It's incredibly risky, right? That doesn't work. And that's why sort of, you know, in modern, you know, software development, you use distributed version control systems in which there's a full copy on every machine where the person is working. And so that's what that single point of failure, you know, the one entity controlled, you know, sort of central place where it should be, that makes me uncomfortable.
And it's interesting. Sorry, we're seeing, I think that's sort of, I think of that as the BitTorrent model, the peer-to-peer model. Mm-hmm. We're seeing that sort of bleed into other areas too, even media, you know, lots of streaming, I think Popcorn Time or whatever it is, you know, a lot of that media is effectively peer-to-peer distributed. There is no, it doesn't exist in a specific place. It's being constantly streamed from multiple users.
Right, exactly.
Yep.
I want to see more of that.
And I want to see that backup feature. I absolutely, it's the perfect idea for the Chromebook. Anyway, Sundar Pichai, if you're watching, and I know you are, Sundar, I know you're watching every minute of the show. Give us the backup. We need it. Well, in just a sec, we're going to come back and do the Google changelog. But first, I want to tell you about our third sponsor today, which is Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending. We talk about the BitTorrent model for content. We could we also have a BitTorrent model, not really, for money. In 72 hours, you could have $35,000 to cover your needs. What would you use it? What would you do with that money? Would you pay off your credit cards, your high-rate credit cards? Would you start a business, do home improvement projects, rebuild your kitchen? Find out how easy online application is for Prosper. Provide a few details and see a rate online almost instantly. You can go there immediately and check it out. Personally, I see this as an alternative to crowdfunding for some people. Of course, crowdfunding sites is a fantastic trend, but it's not for everybody. And the reason is that Kickstarter projects and others are a huge amount of work before, during, and especially after you reach your Kickstarter goals. And so if you just want to start a business and don't want to fritter away all your time with the fundraising, Prosper is the way to do it without diverting your time and energy on the fundraising itself. Prosper is Silicon Valley's answer to personal loans, and with Prosper's innovative peer-to-peer lending process, there are no outrageous fees, no raising interest rates, and you'll never set foot in a bank. Remember the bank, those guys that created the financial meltdown? Prosper has more than 2 million members and over $1 billion in funded loans. For a limited time, Prosper is offering Twit fans a $50 Visa prepaid card when you get a loan. So go to prosper.com/twit, and that's a special rate just for our audience. Up to $35,000 in just 3 days and a $50 Visa prepaid card. Go to prosper.com/twit. Well, Gina, are you ready to do the Google changelog?
I'm always ready. Let's do it.
We'll hear the trumpets.
The Google changelog.
Right on. We have some really cool new features coming down the pipe in Chrome. We know because the earliest version of Chrome, Canary, which is, of course, the most unstable sort of developer version of Chrome, often previews these features. And there are two new ones that I'm kind of excited about. One is kind of goofy. One's really useful. You've already seen in Chrome that if you've opened up a tab and it's playing audio, you'll see a little icon on the tab letting you know that the audio is playing. That alone is useful, but in Canary, they've introduced a feature that lets you pause that sound by just clicking on the icon on the tab. So really nice, smart stuff there. If you've got, say, an ad or something or some sort of music playing in the background, you just click on the tab and you can pause it. Like again, nice. That's in the Canary version of Chrome, but we'll see that. That most likely will come down to the stable version in the next in the coming weeks.
Are you pausing the video or audio, or are you just muting it for a while?
I believe it's muting, so I don't believe it's pausing. I believe it's muting, so it's like, shut up.
Fantastic.
I don't want to hear you right now. Yeah,
that's great.
Because that icon shows up even if it's a video or a flash element that's playing audio. So it's muting. The other thing we're seeing in Canary, there's a hidden endless runner game. So cool. You've seen in Chrome when you're offline, it's got that sort of like that 8-bit dinosaur, which I love. Well, in the Canary build, the little dinosaur still shows up. Can't connect to the internet when you're offline, but I think you tap the space bar, you can start running that dinosaur through the desert, nice. Jumping over cactus, and it gives you a little something to do while you can't get on the internet. I love this kind of thing. It's like, this kind of thing is like a classic Easter egg. Excel had one of these games where you sort of fly around and there was a Tetris game. And anyway, so this is kind of fun. You have something to do with the dinosaur when you can't get online and the new version of Chrome. That's in Canary right now. We already talked about Photoshop on your Chromebook. That is pretty cool. Just to clarify, I was like, how is Photoshop running on your Chromebook? It's actually like, it's streaming Photoshop. So Adobe is going to be running Photoshop on a server somewhere in the cloud. Oh. You install this app for your Chromebook, which gives you like tunnels you into the remote server and connects to your Google Drive. So you're streaming Photoshop over the web versus running a local Photoshop app. So people are beta testing this now. Not clear how fast it is, particularly with giant images. I would love to try this out. But they're testing it now. And I assume that people who pay and have emptied their wallet will get this eventually.
But imagine if that works, what else you could do that with?
Yeah.
It's a cool model.
Yeah. It is. You gotta need a big fat pipe, but sure. Mm. I mean I guess if communication between Adobe servers and Google servers, although is fast enough, then the saves to Google Drive should work, right? I mean if you're basically just tunneling, it's like remote controlling a computer.
The original upload of material to the cloud is the cost. But once it's there, you're working on faster processors.
It
has to save to the NSA server first, but that shouldn't take
that long. They have very fast servers.
Extremely
fast. They got a shortcut straight to the NSA servers as well. New in Gmail, you can now view images within your message full screen. So this is similar to how non-image attachments work. Now this works with images. You can click on large images within a message, and you see them full screen in Gmail on the web. You can click on the Google Drive button to save the image directly to Drive, or the arrow button to download them to your computer. So subtle but nice change for those of us who email images around. And finally, thank you for this. I believe this was Jeff. Google's beefing up their mobile ad offerings. So Google's introducing new mobile display formats and tools that will roll out over the coming months. So advertisers have these new sort of mobile light box ads, engagement ads. How many more buzzwords can I say? They dynamically resize to fit any size across devices. This is part of Google's sort of multi-screen size, multi-device world that we heard a lot about at Google I.O. So you have existing ads that kind of fold and unfold and collapse and expand depending on the device you're looking at in these new formats. So Google's trying their best to crack the mobile advertising nut. And I'm sure that they'll do pretty well. So advertisers will pay when users engage with the ads to expand them. And the ad type will be available soon in the AdWords ad gallery for Google Display Network campaigns. That's all I got.
Fantastic. And jazz. And we have our tool tip and number of the week. Why don't we start with you, Gina, since you're in the mode of talking right now. What do you got in terms of our tip of the week?
A little something from Reddit. And Chad, this actually might have been from you. I did not know this, but Google Drive has got this really neat thing. So if you need to insert a special character in Google Drive, so like if say you're in a Google Doc and you go from to the insert menu, special characters, you can actually draw the character that you're looking for. I never remember the names of these characters.
Wow.
You can draw it and it will search for the character that looks like what you just drew.
What a world.
This is pretty crazy. And, I tried a couple of things and it was sometimes it was more accurate than others, but really neat if you're like, I'm looking for the little, with the doofy do.
The prince used to wear. I want to use that as part of my signature.
I need the euro sign and the pound sign.
The shruggy.
All the time.
A shruggy. They should add those.
That's fantastic. All right, Jeff, your number of the week.
All right. So speaking of Sundar, he says that Drive now has 240 million active users, up from 190 million since June. This is the one that really interests me. Chromebooks, speaking of Chromebooks, are approaching 50% share of the EDU market, up from 5% only 18 months ago.
I'm so happy to hear that. It's such a perfect education device. That is fantastic news.
Yeah.
My son, by the way, he works for a company called Tinker, and they do education. They teach children how to do software programming using a drag and drop. It's like Legos for software, and he said that they just take to the Chromebook as a perfect solution. He goes and he does actual training with kids, and it's perfect because they can just log in, they can do their projects, and they love it, and it just works fantastic. So that's great to hear. Any other numbers, Jeff?
No, I have one quick question for Gina.
Yeah.
Do you believe the reports about the Shamu Nexus 6 Moto XYZ?
The Moto Nex.
I do. I think that it makes sense that they're going to come out with a new device when they release L. It sounds like it's going to be big. 5.9 inches, which is bigger than the OnePlus One, which is pretty big to begin with. This is 5.5.
Oh,
this is 5.5. Yeah, so it's going to be a big phone, according to rumors. It's basically going to be what they're saying. Rumors are saying a Moto X-like device. Motorola is going to manufacture it. Front-facing speakers, pretty excited about that. Coming, obviously with L. I think it sounds credible to me.
Timing?
I mean, I forget now what the rumors were about timing, but I imagine it's got to happen before the holiday season, right? I mean, that makes sense.
It's got to be imminent.
Yeah, it's got to be imminent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's a picture circulating now that look pretty credible. We had a big discussion of it today after Tech News Today, and it looks pretty real. Now, Matthew, do you have anything you want to throw into this, a tool, tip, number, or anything like that?
Does it have to be Google related?
No.
Okay. So this is something interesting I literally just came across before the show. Clay Shirky, who some of you may have heard of, media guru, happened to be in Hong Kong and wrote something about the Occupy Hong Kong protests, which is fascinating. And I definitely think you should read it. Just a sort of, you know, one man wandering around taking photos. But he published it on GitHub, which
That's
I thought was interesting. Yeah. His blog, if you've ever been there, looks exactly the same as when WordPress first launched, you know, 45 years ago. And so maybe he's given up and gone to GitHub. But I find it interesting because, you know, he's clearly experimenting.
Is GitHub not blocked in China and maybe WordPress is?
That I don't know. That's a good question.
I was speculating, but
I just find the GitHub model for text for sort of writing a fascinating idea. And so I'm interested to see him experimenting. I went to look at his article and I think it had only been up for an hour. There were already 3 pull requests and they were effectively typos that someone had noticed and suggested a correction. I think it's a fascinating sort of exercise in distributed writing, sort of peer-to-peer
I've asked folks
editing.
Before how GitHub could be used journalistically, and I'd love to see this be a really interesting experiment in that.
Well, and I'd like to see as it goes on. You know, it's about a controversial topic. There's got to be lots of people interested. If it could become a kind of, you know, if people could add to it and effectively take it and change it and stretch it or add new things to it the way you do when it's software. I just find it fascinating. So,
That is fascinating.
Very neat.
And by the way, Tommy Flowers in the chat room corrected me and said that the plural of Lego is not Legos. It's Lego. And so if Facebook can apologize to the drag queens, I can apologize to the plastic yellow people. And I'm very sorry about that.
It's like moose. It's singular and plural.
Yeah, I never heard that before.
Yeah. Well, apparently it's true. I guess it has to be true. It's in the chat room. Okay, so my toy of the week is PathTalk. Now, PathTalk is a messaging app that nobody uses, and it's a pretty ordinary messaging app, and there's no reason to use it except for the reason that they gave us this week. And that reason is that they now have a new tab called Places. You go to the Places tab, and you select a business of any kind. And then you ask them any question or ask to make a reservation or something like that. They say, we'll get back to you in a few minutes. And then they come back with an answer or whatever it is. And the way this works is this is a human-powered concierge service. They call the business. They get the answer. And then they chat you back as if they're the business. So here's an example. I sent a text on this to the North Coast Brewing Company, their tap room. I said, do you have Lagunitas Maximus on tap? A couple minutes later, they got back to me and said, hello, sorry, we do not have Lagunitas Maximus. In case you'd like to try out our drinks, we're going to be open until 9 p.m. today. Have a great day.
A human being?
That is a human being. And so this is especially great if a business is going to have a long hold time or they're going to give you the runaround. Sometimes you're going to call a big department store and you have something in stock. They have to go check and all that kind of stuff. They do all that stuff. And then they come back to you with the answer. I don't, you know, obviously this is a money losing proposition for Path, but for those of us who don't want to waste time, it's really fantastic. So
interesting.
It's called Path Talk. It's a human powered concierge service. They also actually use a little bit of intelligence. For example, if you call to make a reservation and you say, you know, can you make a reservation at so-and-so restaurant at 7 o'clock? And there's no availability, they'll make the reservation for 7:30 and get back to you and say, how about 7:30? I've made the reservation for 7:30 if you want it. And if you say, no, I don't want that, then they'll go and cancel it or whatever. But they actually have, you know, they're real people who are making real decisions and there's a human touch to it.
Are those human beings that Path employs? So they are Path employees who call the restaurant?
They, my guess is that this is offshored and outsourced. That's just my guess because otherwise they'd be nuts to just have people, you know, sitting in New York City, paying New York City rent and paying New York City whatever.
They effectively pay them to do this.
I believe so. This is an acquisition by Path I don't recall the name of the company offhand, but they acquired a company that did this. And apparently they're using it as a reason for you to go use their messaging service. I don't know how long it'll last. They also have, in addition to using what is actually the Foursquare database of companies, they're also augmenting it with their own. And an interesting experiment that I had was I asked for the business hours, and instantly I got back the posted business hours for that business and said, oh, their posted hours are XYZ. They still contacted them to verify that today's closing time was XYZ, and they got back to me with that information as well. So they have some automation. They have a database that's four squares, and they also have their own database of information. Really fantastic. So far in my experimentation, it's been kind of thrilling to use because usually information like this is cumbersome to get, and they do it all. So it's just a great thing, and it's free.
But we know that humans don't scale.
That's right. They don't. But that's
yeah,
not my
use it. That's use not my it problem. While it's still around, kids.
Yeah, use it while it's still around.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Well, do you guys want to talk about anything else, or should we close up the show? What do you think? Any other topics?
I think we're good. This is a great show.
I think we're good. Yeah. Good show.
I love this show. Good. So great to be able to talk back. I listen and watch this show every single week, and it's just so great to chime in. It's like I sit there and I talk to myself in the kitchen when I'm doing the dishes and listening to the show.
So no, Jarvis, you idiot, no!
Jarvis, Jeff!
And I should point out Kevin Toefel, one of our mobile writers, has already given me crap for dissing his video, his slow-mo video of his dog, Norm. So
yeah. Twigs got reached, man.
I apologize unreservedly for that. Norm is excellent. You should all watch the video.
We love Kevin. He's a frequent guest on Tech News Today, and he's a fantastic interview subject.
Should have Norm on as well. Guy. Norm's
yep, Android.
Yep, absolutely. Well, Gina Trapani, creator of ThinkUp.com, host of Twits All About Android, thank you so much for your never-ending hosting skills.
Thank you so much for filling in for Leo. This is a lot of fun. Great show today. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. And Jeff Jarvis, professor of journalism at the City University of New York, other Republic parts, What Will Google Do, and Gutenberg the Geek. Are you going to be impressed, do you think, by Eric Schmidt's book about Google, How Google Works?
So I went to speak at Google, and they gave me a copy of the book.
And? I mean...
I enjoyed Larry's... my old bud, Larry.
Yeah.
Larry Page's forward was actually pretty good, very brief. Maybe we talk about it next week. And I'm going through some of the book. It's very business booky.
Yeah. Yeah. And his previous book, Eric Schmidt's previous book about, what was it, about the future or something like that?
Yeah.
Was almost unreadable. It was so dull. Yeah. So if you want a great book about Google, What Will Google Do?
Oh, Chuck's thanks.
Yeah. Because it's thrilling to read. Matthew Ingram, senior writer at GigaOM, excellent writer, excellent observer of the journalism world. Thank you so much for joining us today as our guest.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
All right. We do This Week in Google every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. That's 2000 UTC. You can watch the show live at live.twit.tv every week or subscribe to the show at twit.tv/twig. Thank you for joining us today, all of you out there, the chat room, and all of our hosts and guests today. Leo and the gang will all be back next time on Twig. Thank you again. This has been another episode of Twig.